This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Romina Baccia, Director of Federal Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. She authored a piece last week or so, 2 years of Sounding the Alarm, Reflections and Progress on Addressing the U.S. Debt Crisis. Our national debt is now north of $35 trillion. And she authored this piece as she celebrates her second anniversary as being the director there at the Cato Institute. Romina, welcome to the show and congratulations on your second year anniversary.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for joining us. A lot of folks kind of ignore what this number is with the national debt. If you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, if you would kind of explain, you know, why is this important? And then we'll move into the meat of your article about some of the good things that have happened and some of the not so good things.
I think over the past few years, people have really come to experience the negative consequences of a government debt that is too high because we had massive inflation. And that's something all Americans got to experience, whether it's at the grocery store, seeing their rent checks go up, or at the gas pump.
That was
in large part a result of the stimulus spending from the pandemic, and also just a massive blowout in emergency spending that the government undertook during that time, far in excess of what was necessary to respond to the pandemic. The issue we have with the budget now, and the $35 trillion debt is symbolic of that, is that government spending, now that we're out of the crisis, continues to grow at a massive pace. Washington is running deficits of about $2 trillion a year, which if you look at as a percentage of our economy, those deficits are as large as crisis deficit. But the reason now is not that we're responding to a crisis, but rather that we have legacy programs on the book that are growing rapidly in cost, and Congress has not taken action to rein these costs in. And that's primarily programs like healthcare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, but also Social Security, which is growing rapidly. And so these spending increases are now baked in. And so the inflation that we just got to taste following the pandemic may very well become a long-term reality over the next decade plus.
So also for the benefit of the audience, what you just said, I think, is incredibly important. We all have our own budget at home. We balance our checkbook, so to speak. So they are spending right now $2 trillion more than what they're actually receiving in revenue, right?
This is correct.
So in simplistic terms, they're spending money they really don't have, so that we're borrowing this money and the interest cost on the money that we're borrowing is eating us alive in many respects.
Yes, interest is now the fastest growing spending category, surpassing even healthcare spending increases and also other benefit spending increases, like for Social Security and veterans benefits, which has been some of the other fast growing categories. And some of that is because of the higher interest rates that also came about due to the inflation and the Federal Reserve trying to bring inflation back down. But some of it is also the government crowding out our credit markets. And what does that mean? It means there's less money available for businesses and for individuals to borrow because the government is borrowing so much. Because there is, you know, credit is a scarce resource, just like other resources that we have available. And so when the government uses up more of the credit, that leaves less for businesses and for individuals. And that then means higher interest rates for things like mortgage, a car loan, or for someone who wants to build or expand their business. And all of that downstream translates into lower living standards for Americans, especially when it comes to businesses not being able to get off the ground or expand, and therefore also not being able to innovate at the pace that Americans have become accustomed to. So there's real costs to all of us that are often unseen when the government oversteps, overreaches, and gets too big. And we experience this through higher prices. We also experience this with Americans feeling like they can't get ahead no matter how hard they work, because getting ahead means having an economy that is growing, that provides new opportunities for individuals, and that comes about when people are able to start and expand businesses. And when they can't get the credit to do so because the government is sucking up all of the credit in the market, then that means that we all get to suffer, and people don't always know where to point the finger. And that's sort of what I'm trying to help with.
Romina, both candidates right now, both Vice President Harris as well as former President Donald Trump, are proposing tax cuts. So with a tax cut, that means less revenue coming in. And how did they explain around that, and whereby the national debt would not exponentially increase as a result of these tax cuts?
You know, it's really remarkable how both candidates have been able to just pretend like we are not already in a debt crisis. And they're continuing to do this. Now, on the Democratic side, they're saying they want to raise taxes on the wealthy. And there's a number of bad proposals that would actually hurt the economy. And if your tax increase actually reduces economic growth, it's like shooting yourself in the foot. You're not actually able to get ahead. But overall, this election cycle really has been marked by candidates from all sides falling over each other, trying to provide new handouts to people, couching it in tax cut language or tax credit language. But a lot of these are actually spending programs, like the expanded child tax credit that both Kamala Harris and J.D. Vance would support. And so those electoral promises are completely unaffordable. And there's been no mention of how either candidate would address the very real predictable debt crises that we're in, and that is getting worse every day that we neglect to fix this deficit and debt problem. And, you know, the one thing I would say that when people hear we're going to give you tax cuts and there will be new spending increases and everyone gets something and nobody has to pay the price, you can translate that into we're just going to print the money. When we run out of the ability to borrow the money because investors are going to start looking at the United States as less of a good credit risk than we've been in the past, if we don't pay our debts, if we don't stabilize our finances and get towards more of a balanced budget, then we'll eventually run out of investors wanting to buy our debt. And then what's going to happen? Well, we saw this during the pandemic as well. The Federal Reserve just started running the printing presses, and that's why we had all this inflation. And now the Federal Reserve has reined that in because of the inflation blowout that happened. But over the long term, if we continue on this fiscally destructive path, we're going to destroy our money because they're just going to have to print it, and that causes price increases, and that erodes the purchasing power of every dollar in your wallet, every dollar in your savings account. And what we know as well is that that tends to hurt lower income Americans the most, who are less able to shield their savings from inflation by, say, investing them in real estate or in the stock market. You know, wealthier people can hedge. They can see it coming. They can hedge and protect their savings. But lower income Americans whose paychecks can't keep up with inflation, whose savings end up getting eaten up by the increase in prices, they're the ones who will suffer the most.
Look, it's amazing how, you know, we've set up like there's these degrees of separation where folks don't ultimately, you know, get impacted by these decisions. And I did a monologue on this yesterday about don't think that by taxing the wealthy that you in the middle class and you in the lower socioeconomic classes are not going to be impacted, because you will be. And, you know, no one can explain away that impact. Let's pivot real quick to credit risk. What is the U.S. credit rating at the present time?
Well, we've been downgraded. We used to have a triple A rating among all of the three major credit agencies. In 2011 was the first time we got downgraded by Standard and Poor's to double A. And then Fitch downgraded us late last year. I want to say it was in August, actually, roughly a year ago now. And then Moody's followed with a negative outlook. So they haven't downgraded us yet, but they've given us a negative outlook. So our credit rating has already suffered. In international comparisons, we still have a fairly high credit rating compared to other nations that are indebted as we are. And one of the reasons is that the U.S. dollar, you know, is still the global reserve currency, and that gives us a buffer where the United States can borrow more than other countries could. But right now, our politicians are acting as if they can borrow however much they want and it will never come back to haunt them and there won't ever be any consequences. And that's just not true. Other nations that have operated this way, like the UK used to be, the pound sterling used to be the global reserve currency. After World War II, what allowed the United States to step into that role was in part that Britain had over-leveraged itself, not just for the war effort, but also by expanding its entitlement programs significantly, including the National Health Service that the UK has. And so they spend themselves into so much debt that they actually lost their role as the global superpower. And that's a status that the United States enjoys today, but it's a status that was hard-earned, and that in order to maintain, we need to be more disciplined, especially when it comes to government finances.
So when we talk about these, again, with these tax increases, I was reading a series of articles over this week, and I'm sure you have read the same ones, that wealthy Democrats now are pushing back against these proposals because they see that this puts them and their businesses and their access to capital at risk, right?
Yes, and we're seeing this especially with the so-called SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction, where you have Democrats, especially in high tax states like New York and California, some of the big campaign donors to the Democratic Party as well, pushing for them to get their state and local tax deduction back. The problem, of course, with that is that if the federal government gives states like New York and California a tax deduction for their high spending and tax policies, that is revenue that is missing from the federal government, and we are actually subsidizing these states and their policies, which doesn't make any sense for the rest of the country. Like middle Americans, people living in the middle of our country, shouldn't be supporting fiscally irresponsible states on the coasts. And but that's one of the examples, and you can see the hypocrisy on both sides. There's sort of that hand waving, we're going to tax the wealthy, we're going to tax the rich, whatever that means, just somebody other than you, and everyone's going to get more benefits. That's sort of what we're witnessing in this election cycle. It's like a Santa Claus kind of policy where we've got gifts for everyone and they're coming from somewhere else, right? Nobody's paying for anything. And that's just not sustainable. And if you look at where we're headed, you know, Europe is a good example of where the United States wants to have now a European-style welfare state, massive welfare state with middle-class entitlements abound, and wants to finance it with low taxes. Well, that doesn't work. So our options are we can have a debt crisis, we can print the money and have an inflation crisis, or we can eventually raise taxes on the middle class and lower income Americans, which is what they're doing in Europe. So there might be a combination of those three, but to think that we can just have such generous welfare programs and continue to expand them and never pay for them, that's just crazy. It's insane to believe that's how the economy could work.
And we don't really see, I mean, in your article, you talk about there were some bright spots, you thought, I guess, in some respect, as some of the new leadership and some of the things that were being talked about, they did pass some things that were positive in nature. But still, overall, we're really putting ourselves behind the eight ball, right?
Yes, overall, we are still digging a deeper hole with our debt and rising deficits. But there has been some progress in Congress. I was very encouraged when Speaker Mike Johnson refused to pass a massive omnibus, which is when they put all the spending bills in one package and shove it right down Americans' throats over Christmas. We were able to avoid that, and I think that overall reduced the size of the package that ultimately got passed. He insisted on separate votes also for things like Ukraine aid and Israel aid and Taiwan aid, and I think that also helped to reduce the size of these packages. So it's sort of like we spend more, we increase the deficit, but by less than might have otherwise been the case. I've also seen the House Budget Committee try to take more forceful action against the executive overreaching by providing all the student loan debt relief by executive fiat without congressional approval. That's a real overreach by the Biden administration that is costing Americans hundreds of billions of dollars and is now one of the key drivers of our debt crises. They're also trying to tighten up how Congress budgets. There's been a lot of gimmicks that have made their way into the budget process. They've abused categories like emergency spending, which let them spend more than they agreed upon by just labeling something an emergency. And the House Budget Committee is trying to rein those in. And we've been helping them with those efforts as well to bring light to these issues and demonstrate how emergency spending has actually contributed more than $14 trillion to our $35 trillion debt just over the past 30 years. So this is a significant and sizable loophole that we need to close. And Jody Arrington, a Republican from Texas, who's the chair of the House Budget Committee, is working on that now. The one area where I was really encouraged, where we've sort of seen more radio silence recently, has been the establishment of a fiscal commission to stabilize the debt, to bring lawmakers across the political spectrum together to discuss the options on the table, weigh all the trade-offs, and then put forth a package that will reduce the growth in the debt and avert a debt crisis. There was a bill that passed the House Budget Committee in January. Then a lot of opponents came out of the woodworks accusing the bill sponsors of details that weren't even in the bill. There were a lot of lies. I tried to debunk some of them. But with this election cycle now heating up, lawmakers have decided to just be silent on the topic. However, there will be another opportunity, I think, to bring back the fiscal commission idea. And that might happen in the lame duck after the election in November. But it all depends also on what happens with our economy. You know, things like reining in our deficits and debt, politicians find it a lot easier when we're in a crisis. So should the United States find itself in a recession, which some are predicting potentially for early 2025, especially if the Federal Reserve will cut rates next month, it could delay a potential recession. That might be the time where Congress will be looking for things like, you know, how do we cut spending and rein in deficits and fix our long-term debt crises? And that's when a fiscal commission might come up again.
And I did want to point out to the listening audience, I know that you won't, Romina, that you know about, you know, when they have a lot of falsehoods talked about, because a lot of what they're considering are actually ideas that you and some of your peers have been putting and pushing Congress to adopt, right? And y'all have been successful in many of the suggestions and proposals that you guys have put forward to try and rein in this debt, quite frankly, because it's, in many respects, I think it's easy to characterize it as a runaway train. And we kind of just forget where this is going to end up, and it's going to be ugly. It's coming home to roost. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, right?
Yes, and we want to make sure that lawmakers have the knowledge and the tools to make better decisions when they find themselves in a crisis, because often lawmakers won't act until they're pushed up against a hard deadline or they're in the middle of a crisis where the American people expect them to take bold action. And that work needs to happen behind the scenes well in advance to make sure lawmakers are familiar with the tools available, the proposals that will actually make a difference, and they reach for the right ideas at that time instead of harmful tax increases that could undermine our economic growth. We want to make sure that there's ideas there that deregulate, that will allow for more growth, for businesses to grow and thrive and to hire more people, but also to cut spending to create that space where the American people and businesses can thrive instead of being choked by the stranglehold, not just of red tape, but also of our ever burdensome national debt, which, you know, is obviously we're paying for it in the form of higher interest rates and also higher prices on everyday goods and services.
Absolutely. Romina Baccia, we love your work. Keep up the great work. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, congratulations on your second anniversary of being the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. When we come back, we'll visit with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, headed your way. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Folks, we are joined by Ron Fauché. He's a political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We thought we'd bring him on because there's nothing going on right now. Right, Ron?
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. In fact, this whole election's been a snoozer.
It's an election about nothing, right, at the end of the day.
Right, right.
So last night...
Well, it may be about nothing, but there's a lot going on.
Last night, the much-anticipated sit-down interview finally came and went. And your thoughts?
Well, I thought that that Kamala Harris got through it fairly well from a political standpoint. But I do think for anybody who listened carefully, you know, it was sort of a festival of avoiding questions and not really confronting, you know, the questions very well. And Dana Bash, who I generally think does pretty well on these things, just let her slide. I mean, she didn't come back and follow up on the non-answers and didn't push. And so generally speaking, I think Harris got politically out of it what she needed, which was basically no big mistake, no big disaster. But I have to say, frankly, it wasn't a particularly impressive performance.
Yeah, I kind of summed it up the same way. I mean, this whole thing about my value system hasn't changed, but my policy positions have. And I was asking the question earlier, especially as it relates to climate, how do you quantify that, right? I'm still very strong believer of climate change and clean energy and this, that, and otherwise. But fracking and all that other fossil fuel stuff, that can go on. We can do both at the same time. But, you know, after all these years of saying how bad that was for the atmosphere, the climate, and everything else, how do we justify this position? And can we quantify it on a graph? You know, how much do we lose as it relates to our clean energy progress by allowing all of that to go on if we were to believe everything they said about that industry?
Sure. Well, Dana Bash should have asked her, well, does that mean your values are separate from your policy positions? Because in effect, that's what she's saying. The values,
obviously,
the values
they are.
Haven't changed, but the policy positions aren't. So in effect, you know, there are two different things, and one of them is political that you do right before an election, and the other is something that lasts beyond elections. I mean, it was a statement that you use in an interview to get through the interview, but it really makes no sense. And there was nobody on that interview to call her out on it.
Would it be safe to say that that's kind of a refined, very refined definition of a chameleon?
Yeah,
you're going to be all things to all people, no matter what my value system is, right?
Yeah, but you know, the other thing too is the changing, you know, from one political campaign to another, and you know, you have a situation here where, you know, that she had certain positions when she was a candidate for president on her own 4 years ago. And then she changed a lot of those positions after she ran for vice president, which, by the way, is nothing unusual. Vice presidential candidates often change positions to align themselves with the presidential candidate. I've never thought it was such a great thing, but I guess when you're in that situation, you have to move quickly, and the presidential candidate isn't expected to do that.
Right.
But now she has a third set of policy positions. And so I think, you know, there's a credibility issue there. Now, you know, Harris supporters will say, well, what about Trump? You know, everybody always says, what about the other candidate? And they're right. You know, Trump has moved around on issues, too. You know, he started off as being kind of a moderate Democrat and, you know, pro-choice and pro a lot of things that he's now against, or at least his political base is against. So we have a presidential campaign where the candidates have been all over the place. And frankly, none of them are confronting issues in a particularly careful or honest way. I think it's all politics. It's all sound bites. And the thing I think voters should look at is, well, when you hear a candidate speak and answer questions, does that candidate display a thought process? You know, do you feel like they're thinking about these issues? Do you think they're assembling information they have to come up with a statement about it? You know, and politicians like, you know, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton did that. Nikki Haley, you know, who ran for president this year, I think did that pretty well. And other politicians have done that. But then you have some like Kamala Harris, and I thought Ron DeSantis was like this as well, that, you know, there doesn't seem to be a thought process involved. It's just, you know, pandering to the audience and at the same time just reading sound bites and reciting sound bites. And I think that's what we saw last night.
Yeah, it's and it seems as though I was reading some articles where Democrat strategists they may be right. Quite frankly, at the end of the day, they think they're going to be able to continue to get away with this because they do believe that Trump will not do the homework necessary to really call her out in a very, as you just pointed out, this thought process, right, where you're connecting all the dots and you point out the hypocrisy and how things work realistically are completely contrary to what they're saying to you, and that he won't do the work necessary to do so.
Well,
and I believe that they may not be wrong.
Well, you know, I think you've hit the nail on the head here, because I think that is right, that Donald Trump in some ways prides himself on not spending time preparing for debates and interviews and that sort of thing. And he has, you know, each campaign is different and each campaign requires something different from the candidates. And there were things he could get away with in 2016 that he can't get away with now. And in terms of, you know, talking about his opponent, talking about the issues, you know, because he was the change candidate then. And Hillary Clinton, in effect, represented the status quo. And frankly, she wasn't that appealing of a candidate. In this particular case, you have somebody who is an incumbent, who is running as a change candidate, and he's sort of fallen into the trap of being, you know, the old man relic from the past, and he basically needs to tie her to the Biden administration. The polls still show that the Biden administration is viewed by a majority of Americans as a failure, and to tie her to that, and to tie her to the issues that where she's moved around a lot and where the Biden administration is weak, but he isn't doing that in a clear, sharp way. When he does it, he overstates everything, he overreaches on everything, You could have, you know, I mean, that's my point about this election, that we're not getting a discussion here of some important issues, and the candidates aren't doing a particularly good job explaining their views on important issues. They're throwing out sound bites, they're throwing out sentences, and neither one of them seems particularly well prepared to deal with any of this in depth. And I thought we saw that last night, and I think we see that with most Trump interviews.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Let's get to a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the most recent polls that you cite in your most recent Lunchtime Politics publication that was put out yesterday. We'll be right back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, the polls seem to reveal that Vice President Harris got a bump from the DNC, the Democrat National Convention, but it looks as though it may be waning a little.
Yeah, I think, first of all, you've got polls bouncing all over right now. And again, I would caution listeners here to be careful not to take any one poll, you know, put too much stock in it, because some of these polls were taken, you know, earlier than other polls, and I'd rather look at just the most recent ones. And the most recent polls are basically showing that Trump, Harris got about a 2-point bump in her convention, which in a close race is important. But but it also looks like over the last week that bump has now dissipated, and the last several polls that came out, you know, two of them showed she's a point ahead nationally, and one of them shows Trump is a point or two ahead, and then there are some different numbers when you include the third candidates or when you don't include the third candidates. So so the bottom line, I think, is that she is probably ahead by a small margin, and it's a close race.
So what happens with this third-party candidate on some of these ballots? Is there time but to have the name removed, or is that pretty much established already?
Well, it depends. You know, yeah, I mean, it depends on the states. You know, there were some states Kennedy didn't get on the ballot, and there were some states where he did. There's some states where they can take him off, in some states where they can't. But they have three other candidates in the race, too. You know, you have right. Cornel West, who's sort of a left-wing candidate. You've got Jill Stein, who is a left-wing green candidate. And then you have a libertarian candidate who, you know, sort of mixes both of them somewhat and could emerge as a protest vehicle for voters who are looking for something else. But none of those candidates are really polling much now. When Kennedy got out and Harris was in, the third party vote pretty much collapsed.
It's let's pivot real quick. The picture for the U.S. Senate, it seems as though that's getting almost uglier by the day in some respect.
Well, you know, again, it's close. The Democrats have a one seat advantage, depending upon who gets elected vice president, may be able to flip the control of the Senate one seat either way. The Democrats have a lot more exposure. They have a lot of seats up for reelection, and it's usually not good for a political party to have a lot of seats up. Again, the bottom line here is that it looks like that the Republicans, at this point, they're assured of a one-seat gain from West Virginia, and there are two or three other states where they are at least have a 50% chance of picking them up at this point. So if you had to bet on it, you'd probably bet on the Republicans picking up a Senate majority. It may only be by one seat. But the presidential election could have an influence on that. And if one of these presidential candidates starts pulling away and you know, really builds up a vote, a good voter turnout effort on their side, it could very well flip some of these Senate races. But the most recent polls, though, have shown that some of these Senate candidates, particularly in Nevada, the incumbent, is doing very well. And she was Jackie Rosen. She was expected to be in a tough race, but she's got a pretty good margin right now. So it's a mixed bag, as it often is in Senate races. It's a small number of races that matter. And like the presidential race, a lot of them are still very close.
No, absolutely. Anything post DNC that has surprised you?
No, not particularly. I mean, here and there, there are some numbers that pop up. Like, you know, what one number that popped up out of one poll is that only 40. You know, even though Kamala Harris is seen as being a very likable, joyful candidate, only about 44% of the electorate said they like her as a person, which you know, which is well under 50. You know, but on the other hand, when you look at the sort of the world view of where voters are, her sort of world view seems to be more in vogue right now than Trump's. So, you know, so you have all these cross currents. And the thing about it is you've got Trump, who is a former president, who is, you know, completely known by the electorate. And you have Kamala Harris, who is the vice president. And even though people know who she is, they don't know much about her. So they're still learning about her. So there's a lot of dynamics at play here, which means this election ain't over. And it's going to be very, and it looks now like it's going to be very close.
Yeah, it'll be one of those barn burners for sure. Ron Fouché, as always, we appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, that's Ron Fouché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, folks. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot when we get back. I want to wish everyone a great Labor Day weekend, and stay safe, too. I mean, you know, a lot of crazy driving going on out there. The weather's not supposed to be that good, so please pay attention to that. Take your time, exhibit some patience, but have a wonderful and safe Labor Day weekend. Scoot's headed your way, and he's going to be talking about the unofficial and emotional end of summer as we celebrate this Labor Day weekend, and a lot of college football this weekend. What teams will you be cheering for? And he's going to talk about Governor Landry said he wants a new policy requiring all athletes to be on the field for the playing of the national anthem, or they will lose their scholarships. LSU released a statement rejecting that request and said players will be in the locker room like they have always been. And he'll talk about the interview with Kamala Harris last evening as well. Have a great weekend.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fouché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, the polls seem to reveal that Vice President Harris got a bump from the DNC, the Democrat National Convention, but it looks as though it may be waning a little.
Yeah, I think, first of all, you've got polls bouncing all over right now. And again, I would caution listeners here to be careful not to take any one poll, you know, put too much stock in it. Because some of these polls were taken, you know, earlier than other polls, and I'd rather look at just the most recent ones. And the most recent polls are basically showing that Harris got about a 2-point bump in her convention, which in a close race is important. But but it also looks like over the last week that bump has now dissipated, and the last several polls that came out, you know, two of them showed she's a point ahead nationally, and one of them shows Trump is a point or two ahead. And then there are some different numbers when you include the third candidates or when you don't include the third candidates. So so the bottom line, I think, is that she is probably ahead by a small margin, and it's a close race.
So what happens with this third party candidate on some of these ballots? Is there time but to have the name removed, or is that pretty much established already?
Well, it depends. You know, it depends on the states. You know, there were some states Kennedy didn't get on the ballot, and there were some states where he did. There's some states where they can take him off, and some states where they can't. But they have three other candidates in the race, too. You know, you have right. Cornel West, who's sort of a left-wing candidate. You've got Jill Stein, who is a left-wing Green candidate. And then you have a Libertarian candidate who, sort of mixes both of them somewhat and could emerge as a protest vehicle for voters who are looking for something else. But none of those candidates are really polling much now. When Kennedy got out and Harris was in, the third party vote pretty much collapsed.
It's let's pivot real quick. The picture for the U.S. Senate, it seems as though that's getting almost uglier by the day in some respect.
Well, you know, again, it's close. The Democrats have a one seat advantage, depending upon who gets elected vice president, may be able to flip the control of the Senate one seat either way. The Democrats have a lot more exposure. They have a lot of seats up for reelection, and it's usually not good for a political party to have a lot of seats up. Again, the bottom line here is that it looks like that the Republicans, at this point, they're assured of a one-seat gain from West Virginia, and there are two or three other states where they are at least have a 50% chance of picking them up at this point. So if you had to bet on it, you'd probably bet on the Republicans picking up a Senate majority. It may only be by one seat. But then again, the presidential election could have an influence on that. And if one of these presidential candidates starts pulling away and really builds up a good voter turnout effort on their side, it could very well flip some of these Senate races. But the most recent polls, though, have shown that some of these Senate candidates, particularly in Nevada, the incumbent, is doing very well. And she was Jackie Rosen. She was expected to be in a tough race, but she's got a pretty good margin right now. So it's a mixed bag, as it often is in Senate races. It's a small number of races that matter. And like the presidential race, a lot of them are still very close.
No, absolutely. Anything post-DNC that has surprised you?
No, not particularly. I mean, here and there, there are some numbers that pop up. Like, one number that popped up out of one poll is that only 40, even though Kamala Harris is seen as being a very likable, joyful candidate, only about 44% of the electorate said they like her as a person, which is well under 50. But on the other hand, when you look at the sort of the world view of where voters are, her sort of world view seems to be more in vogue right now than Trump's. So you have all these cross currents, and the thing about it is you've got Trump, who is a former president, who is completely known by the electorate, and you have Kamala Harris, who is the vice president, and even though people know who she is, they don't know much about her, so they're still learning about her. So there's a lot of dynamics at play here. Which means this election ain't over, and it's going to be it looks now like it's going to be very close.
Yeah, it'll be one of those barn burners for sure. Ron Fauché, as always, we appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, that's Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, folks. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot when we get back. I want to wish everyone a great Labor Day weekend and stay safe, too. I mean, a lot of crazy driving going on out there. The weather's not supposed to be that good, so please pay attention to that. Take your time, exhibit some patience, but have a wonderful and safe Labor Day weekend. Scoot's headed your way, and he's going to be talking about the unofficial and emotional end of summer as we celebrate this Labor Day weekend, and a lot of college football this weekend. What teams will you be cheering for? And he's going to talk about Governor Landry said he wants a new policy requiring all athletes to be on the field for the playing of the national anthem, or they will lose their scholarships. LSU released a statement rejecting that request and said players will be in the locker room like they have always been. And he'll talk about the interview with Kamala Harris last evening as well. Have a great weekend.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.